No, this is no different than our assembly. Fellowship is a wonderful thing. It's a pleasure to be here. I spoke with Bill a while back that I was going to be in the area, and he said, come on, but that they wouldn't be here, so I missed them. But it wasn't too long ago. Earlier this year, I was here, I think. And so it's a pleasure to be invited back and start seeing some faces that I recognize a little bit more, but names still, you know, I used to be able to just remember names, you know, what goes on in that brain, the connections start breaking or something, I'm not exactly sure, but it is a joy to be here. Does that work? You know? I'm not going to spend any time on commercial there. Just if you're interested, you can check out Scripture on Creation. What I wanted to talk about was sort of the opposite extreme of what I looked up my notes from last time, what I talked about last time. We spent a fair bit of our attention on molecules and discussed the origin of life and a few things like that, although we did talk a little bit about the universe. But we're going to spend our few minutes here this morning in the Sunday school hour and looking at the bigger picture. You know, it doesn't matter whether you go down into the atoms or out to the galaxies, God's glory is revealed. His testimony is clear if you step back from the clamor of the world and all the claims that the world makes about where everything came from. So we're going to consider astronomy in the Bible in these few minutes. And we're going to look at it from the perspective of it indeed is the Creator's testimony. And I would submit that the Bible has a lot more to say about the Lord expressing himself in the stars, in astronomy, we might say, than in biology, than in the molecules. And that makes sense because David and Moses and Peter and those guys, I mean, they didn't really know about molecules. They didn't have microscopes to look into those things. But they could look and see God's glory in the sky. So it makes more sense that God's emphasis on his testimony in creation would come from the expanse of space, the stars. Oh, shoot, I didn't mean to do this. I was going to ask you, our brother just said, oh, you all got Genesis 1 down pretty good. Well, I've already told you the answer, so, because I was going to ask you, all right, you got it down. What day did God create the sun, moon, and stars? And very good, very good. You can read, and you know Genesis 1 just inside and out, I'm sure. You know, it's surprising how often I'll go and to an audience, and I ask them, and a group this size, maybe two or three, get it right. So, day four is when God created the sun, moon, and stars. What day did he create the plants? Very good. The third day. So this is a big problem for people already. Wait a minute, you got plants on day three, the sun, moon, and stars on day four. That's impossible. Well, when did God create light? Day one, okay. What do the plants need to live? They definitely need light, and they need water. Even if God hadn't created light on day one, could the plants have handled it for a day to not have any light? I think so. But you see, one of the things that gets people, you know, what's going on here? Plants on day three, sun, moon, and stars on day four, is we are so infused with this idea of ages and ages and long spans of time in creation. If indeed, which I submit to you is what God is submitting here in Genesis chapter 1, these are days. Even if there was no light shining on the earth, but there was, there's plenty of reason to understand. An evening and a morning, one day, an evening and a morning, two day. What has to be happening? Light is shining on the earth as it's spinning underneath that source of light, whatever it was on day one. But even if there was no light shining on the earth, these are just days. The plants can handle one day in darkness, although they didn't need to do that. But there are several different reasons proposed as to why God waited until the fourth day to create sun, moon, and stars. Some are theological, actually, and I'd like to go into that, but I won't. Day four is what we're going to consider when we're talking about astronomy in the Bible. So it's always good to read the text. Ooh. So we're going to look at the account of day four, Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 through 19. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. And he made the stars also. And God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. There's the earth turning. As it turns, light is shining on it. Shadow on the backside, that's where the evening and morning line moves across the earth as the earth turns. You know, it's almost as though God is bending over backwards as he reveals these things, perhaps to Adam, but Moses is the one who wrote this down for us to see it as it is now. He's bending over backwards to say, you know, this is a day. You know, these are, you all understand this? If the earth is turning, it's a day. In any event, there's the account. Did you notice that in two different ways, God explains, he describes the purpose for the sun, moon, and stars? Why would he even, I mean, isn't it obvious? Well, I think he's making a little clear here as he says, "Let them separate," and that's a purpose clause in Hebrew, so it could have easily have said, "Let there be lights in the expanse for the purpose of separating the day from the night, and let them be for this purpose." Signs, seasons, days, and years. Who cares about what year it is? Who keeps track of the days? The trees are not looking at their number of rings and going, "Wow, you know, I'm a 90-year-old tree." Although, by the way, do you know that those rings are not a real accurate way of telling how old a tree is? But that's used, you know, to say, anyway, it's okay. It's sort of neat to count the rings on a tree. And even who cares about these things? And especially, as this account was given to the Israelites, what was God also establishing? The different festivals that were to be celebrated in the spring and the fall. The seasons that people could determine by what? The moon and the earth going around the sun, the different phases and so forth. Man cares about signs, seasons, days, and years. And I would submit to you that right here in the account of the creation of sun, moon, and stars, God is also indicating to us the purpose was for us. And as we're going to be thinking about this, the Creator's testimony, especially in the sense of the signs of God's greatness revealed in creation, in the stars. Now, there is some understanding, too, that the signs may have been the signs of the zodiac. Of course, man has distorted them. We don't need the story of the gospel in the stars anymore, but it is curious. Some of the things that the stars seem to be saying in the different signs of the zodiac. I mean, man has distorted it so badly that even the order of them are destroyed, if indeed God put the story of the gospel in the stars there to show to Adam, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Look at the story in the stars. But I think we can focus the idea of the sign value of the stars as being God's just display of his glory, his greatness as you look up and, you know, look at that glory. Who cares about days and years? Man does. And so I would submit that they were created certainly because they're necessary for life on earth, but they were created also for our benefit. So next time you go out there and look, just recognize that God put that up there. First and foremost for you to appreciate them, yes, more importantly, him. So, the sun, mentioned first, the greater light that governs the day. Our sun is an average star, and it is a star. We don't think of our sun as a star, but it's a star like the other billions that are out there. It's different because all stars are a little different, but for the most part, size, heat, amount of light, it's an average star. And yet, on a hot day, if you are exposed and you don't have liquid, it can kill you. But it's 93 million miles away. That's unfathomable, that light out there. You go out and it's hot, and you can't look at it. It'll burn a hole in your retina. It's 93, not miles. If it was 93 miles away, you'd just, whoa, what an explosion. 93 million miles away. That's our star out there. Magnificent, incredible. The thing is, did you notice, I tried to emphasize it, in verse 17, and God placed them, speaking of the sun, moon, and stars, God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give the light on the earth. Because, again, this goes so contrary to the way we think. The earth was already there. God didn't put the earth in just the right spot with the universe all out there. God put the universe out there. Maybe I shouldn't put it that way because the time continuum expanse was out there, but it was empty. God put the sun and moon and stars in place as the earth was there, spinning around. And where did he put that sun? He put it in just the right place so that as he, I don't know how he did it, bing, you know, spin a top, spin a penny, you know, as he bing and started the earth going around that sun, as he put it in just that right place, the earth would be in what's called the Goldilocks zone. You remember the story of Goldilocks, right? The bed was too hard. The bed was just right last night, Lori Jo. The bed was too hard. The bed was too soft. But the one bed, the baby's bed, the baby bear's bed was just right. And Goldilocks laid in it, right? The porridge was too hot. The porridge was too cold. The baby's porridge was just right. The earth is in the Goldilocks zone. We are in just the right spot. Not part of the year, but throughout the year. Now, this picture that you see up here, that green zone is the Goldilocks zone. Most planets, comets to the extreme, have an elliptical orbit around the sun. And so what's happening? Part of the time they're going around the sun, they're very, very close. And so the heat is incredibly intense on the planet. Would any liquid water exist on a planet that's 400 degrees when it's being shined upon by the sun? Of course not. Or when it's 190 million miles from the sun, would there be any liquid water on the earth? Absolutely not. It would all be frozen. Whether it's all vaporized or all ice, could life exist on earth? If there were any times during the year that those conditions existed, no. But fortunately, according to the evolutionists, the earth is in the Goldilocks zone all the time, and we never get too close to the sun so that all the water vaporizes. We never get too far away from the sun so that all the water freezes and life can exist on earth. You know, when the NASA astronomers are looking for other planets that are orbiting a star, they're also trying to determine whether they are in an elliptical orbit, which means no life can be on that planet, or if they're in a circular orbit. And to my, I'm not an expert on this, but to my recollection, so far there's been quite a stir about they feel that they found one planet that seemed to be orbiting its star in more of a circular orbit. But there's our Earth. The sun was placed in the perfect spot so that Earth would be in the Goldilocks zone. And then there was the moon, that lesser light that governs the night. You know, the moon also is necessary for life on Earth. Obviously, we have to have the sun, but the moon? We really have to have the moon? And I'm not talking about the romantic value of the moon. I think that the human race would go on whether or not we had the moon up there or not as far as those romantic encounters, but there is a much more important reason why the moon is necessary for life. those things. The waves of the ocean. Twice a day, we have tides. And that is because the moon, again, is at the perfect distance from the Earth, about 250,000 miles, give or take. It's not too close. It's not too far. We could say that the moon is in the Goldilocks zone around the Earth. And because of the gravity of the gravitational attraction between the Earth and the moon, the moon pulls the ocean out. It bulges out. And on the backside, Newton's law, on the backside, it bulges out too. So as the Earth is turning underneath the moon, spinning, that bulge moves. Those bulges move all the way around the planet, causing the tides to rock back and forth. Now, okay, so why do we need tides? Those white caps are putting air into the water, dissolving oxygen, dissolving carbon dioxide, among other gases. And without those gases, the organism's responsible for 70% of the photosynthesis on Earth. You realize, I'm not advocating this, but do you realize if we cut down every tree, burnt down every blade of grass and bush, there would still be 70% of the photosynthesis that takes place on the Earth going on. So don't feel so guilty if you need to cut a tree down, okay? Some of those radical environmentalists, the hand-wringing is astounding. You know, if you cut down a tree, they're beautiful, they do help, but the photosynthesis that the ocean provides and all that plankton and all those organisms that are there would not be able to survive without the carbon dioxide and oxygen that is dissolved in that water. If there were no tides, that body of water would be a stagnant pool of death and nothing would grow on it and there would be no life on Earth. Not too much further away and we'd have no tides. Not too much closer. And what would we have every day? Double tsunamis, and there would be no land. It would not take very long at all for, imagine, two tsunamis every day. The erosion on the land would be incredible. And it would erode away all the land, and there'd be none. So we don't have an ocean planet. We have a planet full of life, and it's because of this marvelous lucky stroke, according to the evolutionists, that we've got this moon at just the right distance. We've got this 70% of the Earth covered with water that supports this wonderful life. We've got these amazing chemical reactions that take light and turn it into glucose. The things just mount up and mount up and mount up to think about how it is that we have life on this planet. It's not just all biochemistry. It's the astronomy of our universe as well that makes it possible. There's our beautiful planet. By the way, that cool-looking little circular cloud there in the Gulf, you see it? This photograph is of Katrina. And as beautiful as that is, remember the devastation. Mm-hmm. We've had some rough hurricanes since then, but the devastation of Katrina. But there's our beautiful living planet. There's other beautiful planets, though, in the solar system. Saturn, some of those storms are as big as Earth. It's hard to imagine. Jupiter with its moons. But how about comets? Do you think of comets as being part of our solar system? You know, they are. And yet, comets are a real big problem for the astronomers that reject God just speaking on the fourth day, sun, moon, and stars. You see, there shouldn't be any comets. Absolutely, without a shadow of doubt, there should be no comets if our solar system is, on the order of 4 billion years. Physicists have determined that it doesn't matter how big of a comet you start out with. You know what a comet is made of, right? Water and rocks. And what you're seeing on that beautiful tail are water crystals as the cosmic radiation from the sun is blasting, solar winds are blasting some of those water molecules, well, not molecules, crystals, off the surface of the comet and then shining on them. So they're just this beautiful, beautiful tail. Physicists have determined that it doesn't matter how big you start, because if you start with a really huge comet, you've just got more surface area to be blasted off. Every orbit around the sun will blast off enough surface to where a comet is only going to be able to survive about 100, you know, give or take, 100 orbits around the sun. And then it'll just be gone. And of course, most of them are just falling into the sun anyway. So 100 orbits. Let's say we've got one that has a period of 10,000 years. So how long is the maximum that comet could have been? We do the math. 10,000 times 100? Right. So that comet shouldn't be here if it's any more than a million years old. If it's a million-year orbit, which is silly, but still now we're only talking about 100 million years. But they're saying that the solar system is billions of years old. What is the period of Halley's Comet? Any of you see it? We've got some that remember Halley's Comet. What's the period? 76 years. That would absolutely, totally, it was ridiculous that it's here. Oh, wait a minute. If our solar system is only 7,000 years old or whatever, well, we've still got several more periods that the Halley's Comet can be going around. All these simple measurements that we can take to demonstrate, you know, there's no way that our solar system can be that old. But scientists can't tolerate that. The evolutionary ones, they can't tolerate. So they got to come up with an explanation for how can we have comets. Well, a scientist named Oort, a Swede, came up with an explanation. He said, you know, there's a cloud of these icy rocks way, way out, extremely far out as part of our solar system. And they're sitting out there, and every once in a while, a star comes by and bumps one out of its orbit, and it starts falling into the elliptical orbit toward the sun. And then it does its thing, and then it burns up after, you know, 100 orbits, and it's gone. But then another one comes along, another star, and knocks one in. And so there's this Oort cloud full of comets that give us our source of comets. So that's how they can be there. Well, that's really interesting because, you know, when Oort had the idea, We could see Pluto even, and we could see some galaxies and stuff, but now with the technology that we've got, surely we've found Oort's cloud if it's out there, right? I mean, we can look out there at the edge of our solar system. Well, guess what? We still don't have Oort's cloud in the telescope. It's not there, but it still has to be there, and still it's still considered to be there. We just haven't discovered it yet. So with all of that discussion about Oort's cloud, Carl Sagan, how do you remember the original billions and billions, Carl Sagan, the younger generation? There's a new guy that's taking his role. But he was sort of chiding his colleagues about all this discussion about Oort's cloud. Here's his a quote from him. Now, granted, it was a while back, over 30 years ago, but here's his comment. Many scientific papers are written each year about Oort cloud, its properties, its origin, its evolution, yet there's not a shred of direct observational evidence for its existence. He was sort of chiding his colleagues. Hey, guys, let's back off a little bit. We're talking about something that we can't prove exists. All right, well, surely now we move forward 35 years or so and we found it, right? Well, in the most recent astronomy textbook I could find, here was a comment about comets. At the very edge of the solar system, so far away that the sun is no longer the brightest star in the sky. Think about that. Think about getting so far from Earth that Betelgeuse or Rigel is brighter than the sun. Cool. Lies the Oort's cloud. The icy exiles here are occasionally nudged out of their distant orbits to plunge toward the sun as long-period comets. The Oort cloud is so remote, we can only infer its existence. Still hasn't been found. So here's Halley's Comet, which doubles as an Oort cloud object. They were just showing different, a blue giant, you know, all the different objects that they study in astronomy. So here's an object from Oort's cloud. They showed Halley's Comet. The Lord continues to demonstrate, to confound the wise of the world and show that, you know, He's the one who hung the stars in space, who put that sun in just the right spot so that Earth could have life on it, the moon in just the right spot so Earth could have life on it. That text that we read, we're not going to go into much detail here. It's about time to finish, I think. But it also said, almost as an afterthought, oh, and He made the stars also. He made the stars also. What is being described there? Well, there's about 200 billion stars in an average galaxy, and we've discovered now 200 billion galaxies, and we're still counting. I can't do the math. 200 billion times 200 billion, but I think it's 10 with 22 zeros after it. That's how many stars are out there. And He just cast them out into space on that day. What? For. The main reason, I submit to you, is for you and me to look up at that Milky Way and see that cloud of stars. Some of those points of light not being a star, but being a galaxy that has 200 billion stars in it. What a God we have. What a power we have. And yet it was touched on this morning in the breaking of bread. As David looked up, he said, Lord, You put these stars in space. What are You doing having any thought toward me? And yet he also pointed out later on in Psalm 40, Your thoughts towards me are more than I could even count. It's because God doesn't care about stars. He cares about you. He didn't come to die for stars, even though He knows all their names. He came so that you could have a relationship with Him. What a God we have. The testimony of our Creator in the stars. Lord, thank You so much for who You are. Your greatness revealed. When we stand before You, what'll it be like? The star maker, our maker. Lord, because of what You've done for us, we love You. We worship You. We thank You for making possible this relationship that we have with You. We bless You in Jesus' name.